Welcome to the DFA podcast. On today's show, we talk about Jared Weaver, rock piles, and a mountain of a man.
Meet me.
It's the DFA podcast, and it's coming your way. Welcome to today's episode of the DFA podcast. I'm your regular host, RJ Anderson of CBS Sports. Ryan is on assignment in Cambodia. So today I'm being joined by a very special guest. You've heard his name before on here. He does good articles for BP. His name is Zach Kreiser. Zach, tell the people something about yourself.
Hello. I was not prepared to tell something about myself, which is a very common thing. So now you've learned something about me.
Zach is unprepared. That bodes well for the show. So on today's show, our big move is not really a big move per se. However, it is a notable retirement. That's because San Diego Padres righty Jared Weaver announced his retirement. So Zach, what do you make of Jared Weaver's career? And what did you think when you heard that he had retired?
I guess I was not surprised that he retired. You really just wish he would have, maybe gone into it like a little more slowly. I mean, he went straight from 31-year-old serviceable pitcher to really bad to actually worse than most minor leaguers in the course of like 2.5 years. And that seems harsh. I mean, he gave up 37 home runs last year. This year he was, throwing just batting practice. And that's for a guy who was a very, very good pitcher, never the best pitcher in baseball or really that close to it or anything. But for a guy who was a very good pitcher in his prime, it was a pretty steep decline. And he's out of the game at 34, which is, pretty early for a guy who made the top of some Cy Young ballots.
So I'm going to bring Brody in here as well, our producer, Sean Brody, because, Rosnick's away, so the Cats can play. So, Brody, what about you? What did you make of Weaver's career in retirement?
Yeah, I mean, I think Zach hit it right on the head. You look at, late 2000s, he was really, really good. He was kind of a cornerstone of that Angels rotation. And I guess he was really part of the last good Angels team at this point. We have to look back and kind of think that. I know the Angels are in a wild card position this year, but generally, was he part of the last good Angels?
Yes. I mean, he had to have been.
He was on the Angels for a decade. I'm sure one of them was good.
Yeah.
He won 20 games in 2012. He won 18 in 2014 without even being that good.
Yeah. And you have to remember, he just left this offseason. So he was there last year as well. So yeah, he's definitely on the last good Angels team. So for me, I have a few points to make about Weaver, and I just wanted to note that foremost, we're going to remember him for the rough end to his career, but he really did have a solid career. He came up in 2006, and he was effective from the jump, and that's impressive because he was just selected in the 2004 draft. So he's a quick riser, and if you look at his career stats, since 2006, Baseball Reference has him with the 14th most wins above replacement player among pitchers, that is. And, the names he's between are Adam Wainwright and David Price. Pretty good company. He was one of, I believe, 13 pitchers during that time frame to record 2,000 innings. I just verified it is 13 pitchers. He ranked 11th there, right behind Lackey and Zach Greinke, even Dan Heron. So, you have to be a quality pitcher to amass that many innings. Even if you look at, some of these pitchers were pitching in 2006, still, it's pretty impressive. And I would also note, in the Brooks baseball era, Weaver went from having a 90-mile-per-hour fastball in 2007 to an 84-mile-per-hour fastball in 2016, 2017. The fact that he even got a job was really impressive because, you think about it, that's, 3-plus grades. I guess that's more than that. That's, 6-plus grades on the scouting scale that he dropped Because it's usually like, well, I guess it's a mile per hour per half. So it's like 3+ grades. That's impressive that he was able to lose 3 grades on his fastball just in the last 10 years and still get another opportunity. And I just wanted to bring up one more thing, because apparently I am the designated Jared Weaver mourner here. I think he changed how we think about baseball or how we look at baseball heading forward. And the reason I say that, and I know you can say that about like every player and it sounds kind of, you know, cliche and whatnot, but the reason I say that is because I think Weaver gave us a different idea of how a pitcher can be effective, not in terms of velocity or whatnot, but because you so often, when you heard Jared Weaver's name in recent years, it was associated with that rock pile out in the Angel Stadium. People would say, you know, it's so hard to see the ball coming out of his hand because of that rock pile, because of that crossfire delivery and the arm action just so happened to take the ball around that that rock pile. I think that's a pretty cool thing to be associated with. I think it changes how we view pitching. It's not just, oh, in relation to the stadium, it's not just, oh, he's a fly ball pitcher, he's a ground ball pitcher. It's, you know what, the way his body interacted with the stadium, it was completely different than what we're used to thinking of, and I really find that cool. I don't know about you guys, but yeah, I find that neat.
I'm not sure if he would find it to be perfectly, because it attributes some of his success to the happenstance of a rock pile being nearby, but it is an interesting way of how he went about it, and it taught us something about how a pitcher can, you know, all these other factors can interact within one pitcher to make him better, worse, or, you know, to affect how he deals with hitters. And that is interesting. It's a funny, I would like to hear someone have a conversation with Jared Weaver about how the rock pile helped his career.
Technically, the rock pile helped all of our careers, Riser.
So we still have to talk about some Jared Weaver canon. I mean, if we're going to talk about Jared Weaver, we got to cover the tweets. It's we have to. So, Kreiser, you want to lead off with the tweets?
Sure. So I don't know how many. If you're not on Twitter, the best thing about Jared Weaver's past couple seasons, when he couldn't, you know, strike anyone out or keep the ball in the yard, was that Jeff Sullivan tweeted about him. Jeff Sullivan, writer at FanGraphs, tweeted lots of things about Jared Weaver's fastball, and I think I'm trying to pick out my favorite one here. Let's see. I think I'm gonna read this one first. So it drops down. It has a slash before each line, and it says Jared Weaver throws glove in frustration. / sits down. Stares straight ahead. Rests hands on head. Head on hands. Picks at teeth. Glove hits wall. Which is, he can't throw anything. He can't throw anything.
Other fastballs honk at Jerry Weaver's fastball on the freeway.
Yeah, this isn't an actual tweet, but it came to mind. Jared Weaver's fastball used to be a spy, but then it got burned.
This is a Jeff Sullivan tweet again. One of my biggest pet peeves is when I'm walking down the sidewalk and I get stuck behind a group of Jared Weaver fastballs.
Yeah, Jerry Weaver tweets, there's plenty more. Every fresh Jerry Weaver fastball ends up with a 5 o'clock shadow. Plenty of them, but probably his most endearing memory at this point is Jeff Sullivan's Twitter, which is not bad, right?
I think now we can move on to the next thing. Now that you just insulted poor Jared Weaver to... Hi, heaven and back. So, Brody, hit us with some rapid reactions. Sorry, hit us with some moves so we can offer our rapid reactions to.
So, changing subjects, the Oakland Athletics acquired Chris Hatcher and Sam Moles. So let's get some hot takes. What do y'all think?
Yeah, so Hatcher's bounced around a bit here lately. He throws hard. You know, he has that rising fastball. You would think, just based on that, he would have more success than he's had. Last few seasons, he's been very home run prone, excuse me. And I honestly cannot think about Chris Hatcher without remembering that he broke Sam Dyson's jaw in a bar fight when they were teammates in the Miami Marlins organization. So that's a fun fact for you. Not quite as fun as the Jared Weaver fun facts, but, you know, it's up there. With Maul, you know, he's a lefty who has a three-pitch mix. Really never got a shot in Colorado, but there was some thought that he could – you know, eventually be a two-way threat out of the bullpen. So it's interesting to see them go down and go out and get someone who hasn't pitched in the majors, but you know, who had the potential to do so. So that's a minor deal, but you know, maybe it pays off. It's possible, you know. So those are two interesting deals for the Oakland Athletics, and you know, they're not very interesting in general. So I guess it's a good sign that they're making some moves to get a little bit more interesting, even if neither of them works out.
I think the Chris Hatcher move was interesting just because he was such a coming out of 2015. I think he had really good numbers in a pretty limited sample in the majors, and then he was kind of going into 2016. He was a big, you know, this guy's gonna be really good. He might be their primary setup man. He, you know, he might earn a bigger role, and then he went kaput and gave up like twice as many homers as he had before, and that level has basically stayed on, even though he fixed a couple things this year. He hasn't been as bad, but yeah, the Dodgers just, if you're only like a mildly serviceable reliever, the Dodgers are just, you're not needed.
Nothing wrong with his arm, however. Nothing wrong with that arm.
So jumping to our next one, we have the Nationals selecting the contract of Alejandro Deaza and DLing Brian Goodwin. So both in their own merit are interesting. Deaza, this will be his sixth team since 2015. And do we think that he's a candidate to watch going forward for the, I guess, Octavio Dotel Award?
No. I mean, Brody, before we came on here, you were basically addressing Deaza as a cursed image. Yeah, I mean, you said, like, every team who gets him, you know, he performs poorly and seems to cost them. And you're right, Deaza has played for the Nationals, the Mets, the Giants, the Red Sox, and the Orioles since the start of 2015. If you go back to the start of 2014, you can add in the White Sox. You know, he's been okay at times, but he's past his point of his usefulness, I believe. Even in AAA this season, he was hitting 280, 368, 403. You figure that's not going to translate in whole, and that's not really as impressive as you might think for a guy who has now a decade of MLB seasons played in. So, you know, this is an emergency move. There's a reason he didn't come up until they absolutely had to have another outfielder. And no, I don't really think there's a chance he's going to hang on much beyond this year to threaten Dotel's record. Or excuse me, to threaten the record that Dotel is currently trying to threaten.
Yeah, he's 33 years old, and he is, you know, if you have Alejandro Daza on your team, you would hope that he's going to, like, run a little bit. I don't know what else he does. I mean, I know what else he does, but he doesn't do anything else that great. And he has dwindled 26 stolen bases in 2012 to 20 to 17 to 7 to 4 last year. And I mean, these have all been basically full seasons, which says something about, well, I guess last year the plate appearances weren't a full season, but he played in a lot of games. But so lots of like pretty full seasons, and because no one has an outfielder apparently, and if he can't run anymore, he's probably not long for the league.
The New York Mets, his former team, who loved to put him in the outfield, they acquired Travis Snyder and signed Neil Wagner. Will either appear in the majors this year?
I'm gonna go with yes on Wagner. Although, you know, it's a reluctant yes. He had pitched well in AAA. If you look at his statistics, 8.4 strikeouts per nine, strikeout to walk ratio nearing three, and ERA nearing three. That said, I'm a little hesitant because if you can't make that Rays bullpen, I don't know, man. Of course, the Mets, as we talked about last episode, don't have a whole lot of relief depth. And so, I'm going to go with Wagner. I don't see how Snyder fits into their plans. It is neat that he's not yet 30, though. You know, that doesn't make me feel as old as I could feel right now. So I'm glad about that. I just don't think he really fits into their plans. And, again, you know, he really did not perform that well in AAA, given that he's been a veteran of, like, eight big league seasons. He hit 290, 372, 430 in the PCL. That's not really outstanding for a dude with his kind of big league service time.
And last season, I don't think he played in the majors at all last season. He was in the Royals system, yep. And he was in Omaha last year for, I guess he maybe had an injury thing. He played 84 games in AAA and only went 245, 340, 350, which is
no bueno.
not what you want when you are a guy who's had some, you know, a lot of major league time.
So we'll move down the line and look at a Minnesota Twins call up with Aaron Sluggers. He's a starting pitcher for their minor league system, former fifth round draft picked in 2013. So he's logged a lot of innings in the minor leagues this year and last. Do we think he's going to help the Twins in the stretch run, and do we think he's actually going to make a difference?
Well, the most important thing here, Brody, is the dude is 6'10". I don't think you can think of Aaron Sluggers without noting he's 6'10". That's very impressive.
Well, knowing Twins too, he's got to throw like what 85 miles an hour, being 6'10". Like,
my goodness, Brody. So, if we just go to his most recent Baseball Prospectus annual comment from 2014, let's just read it. There's plenty to like about towering lefty Aaron Sluggers. A fastball hits low 90s and generates ground balls, a surprisingly repeatable delivery, developing off-speed stuff that could keep him in the rotation, and excellent control that led to 9 strikeouts for each walk in his brief Abbey League stay. His full season debut will be closely watched. So basically, he is the twinsiest of Twins pitchers, except...
Isn't he a righty?
Yeah. Why did they say lefty? Wow.
He's the twinsiest of twins pitchers. No one knows who he is.
I guess they just assumed, well, he must be a left-hander or whatever, you know. Wow, yeah, he is a righty, and his strikeout ratio was 6.7, which is like the Twins' IMDb score. Hat tip to Sam Miller. So, yeah, he's going to fit right in. But you know what? I'm interested to see him. You know, 6'10", tall people got to represent, and I'm interested to see if he can – provide anything of value to this Twins rotation. At minimum, you know, he'll be fun to watch from the sense that, again, he's like a freak of nature height-wise.
Yeah, I Google image searched him because I like to look at how tall pitchers look when they pitch, because sometimes it's really weird and funky looking. He actually looks pretty normal when he throws. Like, if you just pulled up the images of him without, you know, anything or anyone around him where he's just on the mound, you'd be like, oh, that's a pitcher. But then you pull up the one of him next to, some Twins coaches and a catcher with a glove on his head, and the catcher comes up to like mid bicep on Sluggers, which is great.
That's a pitcher.
I love how the Twins always like consistently find these kind of non-strikeout, don't walk anybody, dependent on contact pitchers, and they seem to come from everywhere in every walk of life, and it's a...
They have a factory, is what you're
saying.
Yeah,
like...
They just take random dudes, and they're like, here you go, you know, learn the sinker, learn how to control your pitches, now you're a fringe prospect, but you're going to get like 10 starts for us before you wash away, and nobody remembers you, and... Except for baseball bloggers, so...
I mean, this is actually, like, they're increasing their degree of difficulty. I mean, they have found an actual mammoth, and they're like, yep, he only throws 88. I don't know what he throws, but...
It's beautiful. I love it. I love the weirdness of it, and knowing the Twins, it'll somehow work out, right? Like, do we think that... I know he's starting game two of the doubleheader today, and we're talking today on Thursday, August 17th. I mean, do you think he shuts down the Indians tonight?
No.
I am here for the Aaron Sluggers 17 strikeout.
So nice, he could be splitting. I don't know. Let's move on, Brody, now that we've called Aaron Sluggers a mammoth. And...
So our next person to roast on this podcast, apparently, we're going to go with J.P. Howell, who was DFA'd. RJ, you had some thoughts?
Yeah, J.P. Howell was probably my favorite reliever for a few years there, back when he was with the Rays in 2008, 2011, I think, was probably his best season in that range. You know, he was back then, you know, he was like in competition with Scott Downs for being the best left-handed reliever in baseball, which, you know, now that I say that out loud, doesn't seem like the biggest compliment. But in my head, I was like, you know, this is a nice thing to say about this guy. What was fascinating about him is, you know, he came up as a starting pitching prospect. He never threw hard. He was a left-hander. He could have seen him in the Twin system. He didn't throw hard, lefty, you know. So, but the interesting thing about Hal was his personality. He was really... I mean, let's just put it this way. He definitely seemed like a California cool dude. where like you could see him just like relaxing on the beach all day, not caring. He also seemed like he could have came out of Dazed and Confused. So those are two compliments as far as I'm concerned. And some of his most memorable quotes, I don't remember the exact quote, but I know he ate peanut butter and jelly and Doritos before every game. And that's pretty interesting. But his most interesting quote to me was always, "You should get the Bach, man," in terms of what music people should listen to. Just the idea of, you know, JP Hal listening to Bach really, really makes my day. Like, that's not something I would expect. And yeah, that makes my day. And I'm sad to see him get designated for assignment, but, you know, he had a good run and maybe he'll resurface. Maybe Minnesota will claim him because he's not even 35 yet. Like, he just turned 34 in April. He's still got like 10 years left, you know, based on the normal left-handed relievers. So
I have a weird thing I remember about JP. This is not a weird thing, actually. It's a thing I remember about JP Howe. There was this big ESPN The Magazine story at the end of 2008, which I think he, you know, he had kind of a bad game in the World Series, JP Howe did. And there's a whole anecdote about just how he, in this big Chris Jones story for ESPN The Magazine at the end of the year, there was a whole anecdote about how J.P. Howell dealt with the loss after the game in the locker room. And there's like James Shields is there, like telling him to go take a shower. And
I remember that.
Howell's just like in a daze and goes to take a shower. And James, you know, Shields is kind of like shooing reporters away, saying JP's upset right now. I don't know. I always remember JP Howell for that like human moment that I read about in this story. But he kind of became like the star at the end of the story. That, you know. Anyway, I remember JP Howell for that. And
I mean, we mentioned JP Howell and James Shields were really going down my avenue here. It's just a shame that they didn't, you know, continue that World Series, that they canceled it after the rain delay. You know, what could have been? You know, who knows if the Rays would have came back in that series or if the Phillies would have went on to win it. So shame that they had to cancel that. And shame that we have to move on from J.P. Howell. But what do you got for us, Brody?
I had one more J.P. Howell thing because
– Oh, hit me.
2005, he was drafted first-round overall pick – or 2004 draft, he was taken first-rounder. He broke into the majors, it looks like, before he ever threw a pitch into minor leagues. He had 15 starts with the Royals in 05 before going to AAA in 06. So, I mean, how many pitchers
– That's hard to do.
How many pitchers do you know – how many pitchers can you name that started in the major leagues that are still pitching today?
Mike Leake.
Clayton Kershaw, maybe?
I don't
Clayton
know.
Kershaw, not Clayton Kershaw.
No, I mean, I think it's basically Mike Leake. So wait, Hal appeared in six rookie ball games in 2004, and then he was in the majors in 2005. Okay.
So
yeah, I don't know.
He didn't make the jump immediately. So I misread that then. So.
But he got up there very quickly. I mean, it looks like he made in 2005, and I don't know what the order of this was, but I assume they went in, you know, order of promotions. It looks like he made total 18 appearances between high A, double A, and triple A. So he made 24 minor league appearances before he reached the majors. That's on the low end. I mean, yeah, there's no way around that. That's basically a full minor league season or a little less than a full minor league season before becoming entrenched in the majors. And obviously he went back down, I mean, you know, in 2006 and 2007, he spent a fair amount of time in AAA. But, yeah, that's interesting that he was so quick to rise. But, again, he was he went to Texas. He was a successful pitcher there. And even though he didn't really have velocity, there was definitely reason to give him a shot in the rotation. And, of course, you know, the Royals did that. It didn't go well. And then the Rays, you know, tried it again, and it didn't go well. He's just a little too hittable. Maybe a little too wild to start, but he became an effective reliever. And, you know, it's a shame he got hurt because, again, for a few years there, he was really good. And I know he came back and he had some good years in L.A. and even, I think, one more good year in Tampa Bay, but he was pretty effective. So he has nothing to feel bad about. Shower story and whatnot aside, nothing to feel bad about there if this is the end of it.
So we're going to wrap up here with Nick Pivetta. He was optioned down after his start yesterday. Which is kind of odd, right? Because Nick Pivetta went five innings, gave up five hits, three earned runs, three walks. But he struck out 11 batters, and he struck out eight in the first three innings. So, I mean, I know Pivetta hasn't been great this year, and his 6.25 ERA, and it's not been amazing in his 18 starts, but do we think there's something there still, or do we think it's just he faced the Padres, and so he gets a lot of strikeouts?
Yeah, I find him interesting. I mean, I'm not going to say he's going to strike out 11 guys each time out, but, you know, the fastball-slider combination is interesting to me. Don't know if he's going to be able to stick in the back of a rotation or if he's going to eventually slide to the bullpen. But yesterday's performance was pretty good, even if it came against the Padres. And, you know, a few times out ago, again against the Padres, he struck out 9 batters in 7 innings while allowing, you know, 3 runs and walking nobody. So, you know, he's shown some flashes this season. He had a good start against St. Louis earlier in the year, too. Again, I don't know if he's going to be able to stick in the rotation or if long-term he's just a reliever, but, you know, there's some intrigue there.
I don't know if he has a weird feel thing with it might be the slider, but he has I'm just looking through, like, his game logs here. He has some just, like, 80% of the games his, you know, he's not getting crazy whiffs. He's not doing anything that special. He's, you know, just trying to keep the ball in the park, get through 6 innings, whatever. But he has these spikes where just like 15% of his pitches are swinging strikes, but it only happens like once every couple months, and then it just goes right back down, and he strikes out like 2 people over 5 innings the next day. You know, it's a weird, I don't know if it's something about the way his pitches work. I've tried to look at this for like Garrett Cole before, which is a much larger profile thing, but just whether that slider feel goes in and out and he loses, you know, some bit of his effectiveness or can't do exactly what he wants to do, but that, I don't know, he seems to fit that type of thing where he's still figuring out how to get that on a consistent basis.
Yeah, I think you're right too. I think it's a death thing with his slider, and you know, his fastball is not overpowering to the point where he can, you know, rely on one pitch when his slider feel isn't there, and he doesn't seem to have, you know, a third pitch that would help in those situations either. So I think you're right. It just comes down to slider consistency. Sometimes it's there, sometimes it's not. And, you know, he's sort of hung in the balance of whether he has the feel for the good slider on any given day.
So do you remember the trade that Pivetta came back to the Phillies for? Papelbon trade, exactly. So what do we think of the trade at this point? I know it's a pretty initial kind of retrospective. Papelbon's basically out of baseball and Pivetta's having a bad year, but what do you think?
I think it's fine trade. It made sense for the Nationals at the time, even if you focus on the closer aspect and how poorly that went for Drew Storer and the Nationals. I mean, you know, Papelbon was good at the time, and giving up Pivetta, even if he becomes a back-end starter, I think that's a deal you make every day for the Nationals. And I also think it's a deal you make every day if you're the Phillies, because, you know, they weren't going to use Papelbon at that point. And, yeah, I just think it's fine. It's still fine both ways, even if Pivetta works out to be a back-end starter. I still think it was justifiable on the Nats side. And even if he doesn't, I think it was still justifiable on the Phillies side. I don't have a hot take there. What about you, Kreiser?
It's pretty hard to get past the implosion and choking Bryce Harper thing. But it obviously made a lot of sense at the time. The Nationals needed something. They got a crazy person, but that is something. But they needed something. They went out and got it. Pivetta wasn't, in my opinion, a huge price to pay for that, but he could still become that. But it was a win now team, and they needed a closer. They just happened to pick a mentally unstable one.
Well, I mean, technically, all closers are mentally unstable. I mean, that's kind of a birthright of the thing. The weird thing, and I'm just going to roll into another subject here, but the thing I've wondered about is I remember seeing a quote from Dusty Baker that Coda Glover is too wild for the closer role. And he didn't mean, like, in terms of command. He meant personality. And that has haunted me to this day, because I want to know, if you're too wild to close in Dusty Baker's opinion, how wild are you? Like, what is he doing where Dusty Baker's even like, you know what, I can't trust this guy in the ninth inning. He's too out there. So that's a mystery of the world for me, is exactly what makes Coda Glover so wild.
The ESPN story that probably has that quote in it starts with a Charlie Sheen reference, I think.
can we take for a second how good the Nationals bullpen has been since that trade. That just made me think of it. But they have been like best in the league type stuff since acquiring Doolittle and Madsen and even Kinsler. Like, is that what we all thought was going to happen? Do we think that they still needed more?
Oh, yeah. We didn't think they'd be best in the league, but you know, Doolittle and Madsen have track records of being very successful, and Kinsler, even with his odd profile, can be a perfectly fine middle reliever and had been for a number of years with the Brewers before ascending to closing for the Twins. So I guess I wouldn't have expected them to be best in the league. I don't think they have the most talent, but you know, it doesn't surprise me that they're much improved and that they're even perhaps in the top half of the league. And I think, you know, they have the potential to get a little bit better once Eddie Romero gets back. And if, I don't know, I guess if Matt Albers can keep this up, maybe if Joe Blanton can try to escape the hellscape of a season he's had so far. Yeah, I guess it's not too surprising that they've been better. I just wouldn't have said best in the league.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think they're going to be best, or I think once you get to the postseason, they'll be one of the lesser bullpens involved. But the idea that, you know, they had some weird things where Blake Treinen had just like a total collapse when he was put in the closer role. Sean Kelly has been significantly worse than he was last year. Eddie Romero, I think, has been hurt mostly, kind of on and off. But it was a weird thing all the way around. It takes a lot of bad luck to get Matt Albers up to closing, and that was never going to continue fully. But I just always like if we want to talk about a trade, the Nationals really would like back. I mean, trading Felipe Rivero for Mark Melancon, Felipe Rivero was the solution to their team this year, and they just he was on the Pirates.
If we want to talk about great Felipe Rivero trades, remember that the Rays traded Drew Bettelson, Rivera, and Jose Lobaton for Nate Karns. So, wow, imagine just going through, you know, one of these days we're going to have like a trade retrospective episode where we just talk about Felipe Rivero trades. But before we have that episode, I suppose it's appropriate to close this episode up. So, Mr. Kreiser, you've been a wonderful guest host. Is there anything you want to plug? And if not, tell the people where they can find you, at least.
You can read me a baseball prospectus. By the time this goes up, it might go up at the same time as a story I've been working on. So just go to the front page and see what it is. And yeah, just baseball prospectus, a lot of good stuff there.
You got to tease us. What is it about? The story, I mean.
It is a piece about how Mike Trout fails a lot. I'm not going to go further than that because it's really hard to explain.
If Mike Trout fails a lot, I would hate to think what you say about us. Speaking of that, Mr. Brody, anything you want to plug? I know you're working on an article, right?
Yeah, I have a great kind of look at like a weird Twins reliever coming out soon, Trevor Hildenberger. He's like one of the weirdest pitchers I can think of, not only because like his last name is one of the longest in the American League, and so he has that title because you don't include Austin Bibb and Dirks because it's a damn hyphen, come on. And so Hildenberger is great, right? Because he's pitching super well in the Twins bullpen, and he's a sidearm reliever, and what he really does is he masks his pitches really well, and he mixes that sinker-changeup combo about 80% of the time. He throws those two pitches, and he hides them really well, and like best in the league type tunneling stats when it comes to that. And so I think it's really interesting. The Twins found another guy who is super tall because he's 6'2", and I think he only throws like his fastball. His sinker is 88 miles an hour. When he goes over the top with his four-seamer, it's like 93 or 91, and another just Twins guy, ground ball heavy, doesn't walk anybody, only gives up home runs to Jose Iglesias. It's really, really weird.
As one does. Sounds good. So looking forward to both of those pieces. I am RJ Anderson. I'm all about cross-firing side armors, and you can find me at cbssports.com. Thank you for listening. You're all beautiful people. Have a wonderful day, and we will be back next week. Sans me. But Brian and Brody will be back next week. So enjoy your weekend, everyone.